From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, Regionalism in American Culture Between the World Wars and the American novelist John Dos Passos. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with John Thomas of Brown University about his forthcoming study of regionalism in the United States. Following that, a discussion with Townsend Ludington of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill about his literary biography of John Dos Passos. Both John Thomas and Townsend Ludington have completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Here is John Thomas.
Well, regionalism, Wayne, is the proposition that civilizations and societies can be best understood and managed, not as simply political units like nations or states in this country, but more or less as more or less homogeneous units, defined, for example, by geography or topography or soil. For the cotton belt here in the South, or river valley systems, the Tennessee River Valley, for example, or the Nile or the Amazon elsewhere in the world, or natural resources, for example, the use in what you could call the foundry, the states of Pennsylvania and Ohio and West Virginia, Michigan and Illinois, or by shared cultural forms, by values and outlooks. In other words, regionalism means different things to different people, to geographers, to topographers, to cultural critics, and therefore the areas shift, but they, according to various specialties and various special definitions. But essentially, it's the notion that there are larger, more natural areas in the world that you can plan on and you can work with.
What does it have to do? What is this definition that you're offering me of regionalism? How does that connect with what you call a rediscovery of America? Are we talking now about an intellectual historian's sort of abstractions here? Does it have anything to do with the way the American public conceives of the American landscape?
I think so. I'm going at it as a cultural construct, and I think that the years between the end of the First World War, let's say 1920, and the becoming of the Second World War, let's say 1941, that those two decades really comprise an area of investigation or a subject that is best understood in terms of the tensions, if you will, between the metropolis, the growing cities, and the hinterland, if you will, the outlying areas. Because many of the intellectuals, many of the artists, many of the cultural critics, for example, in this period came originally from what you might call the provinces. They were young men or young women from Middle America somehow who drifted to the cities. And so there's a tension there.
Well, let me stop you on this very point, Jack Thomas. Tease out one single thread for me. If you are dealing with this sort of crossover between ideas and culture, the way people live, name a name for me or pick an idea, and let's trace it from the end of the First World War into the time of the beginning of the Second World War.
Well, the dean of American regionalists, that is the perhaps the leading figure, was Lewis Mumford.
Now, this is an intellectual historian.
He's a man of many achievements, but he is, among other things, an intellectual historian. He's also a regionalist. He's also an urban planner. He's a critic. He's a kind of man of a universal man, if you will. But his career is a wonderfully effective way of looking at regions and regionalism, because Mumford, at the very outset, wanted people to distinguish between what he called regional planning. Now, a good example of that would be the TVA, where you simply decide that you want to build up and to reform and to somehow help the people in the valley with a plan.
Well, economic infusion.
That economic infusion, all kinds of different things, but it's essentially it's a program or a plan, regional planning. He wanted to distinguish that from what he called regionalism as a cultural motive. That is, as a set of values, of forms, of beliefs, of propositions and principles, which have to undergird, have to underlie the regional plan, or else, he said, it'll be just a technological exercise.
Yeah.
So if you watch that, larger notion, that larger definition of regionalism, you can hang an awful lot of people will hang together off that. Novelists.
Yeah.
Take Faulkner. Take Willa Cather.
Thomas Wolfe.
Take Thomas Wolfe. Architects, Frank Lloyd Wright's Broadacre City, or even Eleanor Roosevelt's plan for Arthurdale, Greenbelt Cities. Take painters, take Charles Birchfield, or take the regionalist painters in the Midwest. Once you begin to think that you're talking about a way of life, a persuasion, You can really begin to explore all kinds of different seemingly unrelated people.
Let's turn, Jack Thomas, to some of these intellectual friendships that you are enumerating, that you use to discuss your notions of regionalism.
Well, the concept of intellectual friendship, it seems to me, is very useful for understanding how people relate to each other, how they work with each other, how they share ideas, how they bounce impressions off each other.
You could be talking about Benjamin Franklin writing to the Europeans in the 18th century.
Right. But it is a I envision this study, you see, and this I get, and here we get into the question of craft, how you build or how you create a history. But I want to get across those 20 years with a series of paired intellectual friendships. Let me give you just one example. Lewis Mumford and Benton Mackay. Now, Benton Mackay is best known, if known at all today, as the designer of the Appalachian Trail. Well, he and Mumford collaborated for 30 years and were friends, close friends, who exchanged letters, and their friendship lasted for well over half a century. The two of them, one a New Yorker, a native New York City man, and the other a boy, a small town boy from Massachusetts, somehow make a fit because they supply the lack in each other somehow, and the two of them elaborate a version, one version of my idea of regionalism. That's the utility. Because, you see, Benton Mackay was a forester, and he knew that the kind of world that he wanted had to have some kind of ecological balance. It had to have some kind of underpinning in terms of region. And his region, of course, is defined largely by that chain of mountains that runs all the way from, now let's see how good my sense of geography is, from Mount Katahdin in my home state of Maine to Mount Mitchell in Georgia.
In North Carolina.
In North Carolina.
Right. The highest mountain east of the Mississippi.
There we are. There we are. So that was the, and to save that somehow, to think of that as Wilderness Ridge, and to force either states or the national government or private groups or conservation societies to think about protecting that somehow and making it available to Americans is a significant achievement.
Now, it sounds, Jack Thomas, as though if I wanted to be a little uncharitable here, I could say what we have here is a little worship service going on. You're talking about these intellectual friendships, quote, men of vision, unquote.
That's how books get written.
Do you say anything mean about them? I mean,
yes.
How do we qualify this this notion of intellectual friendship as a contributing element in the regionalist cultures of America?
Let me give you another example where there is a certain meanness. In many ways, Bernard DeVoto was a brilliant man.
But really irascible.
Irascible.
Yeah.
Terribly irascible and wrong-headed in some respects in his judgment of people. He was much better about things and movements and ideas than he was about people. And so he's not an altogether lovable man.
And you
point
this out.
He's an admirable man, but yeah. I think a historian or a biographer has to see this.
You take his grudges into account
take him warts and all, as they say. Uh-huh. Yes, but that can best be seen sometimes by pairing him with another intellectual friend, in this case a disciple. You see, Mumford, mm-hmm. my first example, Mumford and Mackay were collaborators. Mm-hmm. They were colleagues. They were roughly of the same generation.
And who is it that worked with DeVoto?
Wallace Stegner.
Uh-huh. The writer.
The writer.
The novelist.
The student. Uh-huh. The novelist. He's another universal man. He's a novelist. He's an essayist. He does many things.
Well, it's very strange. A moment ago when I used this phrase, men of vision, mm-hmm. Describing, these intellectual friendships that you are writing about in your book on regionalism. And I thought of Stegner's book, Angle of Repose, mm-hmm. People who go west and the pioneers.
Right.
We're back to that. We've never really gotten away from that in American cultural history, have we?
We haven't, but many of the regionalists are highly critical of the pioneer because the pioneer gouges the landscape.
Yeah.
He is destructive. He uses it up and throws it away.
Yeah.
Now you find that in DeVoto.
Mm-hmm.
You find that in Stegner. You certainly find it in Mumford. You find it in all of these people who don't like the pioneer, the real hero, it seems to me, for the regionalists. And this is where their conservatism comes in. The real hero is the person who settles down, who hunkers down,
yeah.
who makes the best of what he has and uh-huh. has a sense of place and saves it and keeps it and tends it.
How do your notions of regionalism come to us in the 1980s? Nostalgia? Are we back
to
that?
No, I think not. I think that we're coming back to the conservational notion, to the preservative notion that the original regionalists had, mm-hmm. that you can't simply mine your country and destroy it, that you can't go without clean water, that you can't have a society that simply uses it up and throws it away. And I think that is one of the legacies and probably the most important legacy is a sense of the land
mm-hmm.
and the place of people on the land and the need to take care of the land. That probably is the largest legacy, and that's no small achievement.
What about its intellectual inheritance or legacy, that of the regionalists?
Their nostalgia may come into it a bit, I think, especially for those of us who are over 50.
Uh-huh.
That is, we, in a certain sense, that's history to us. It's history through rose-colored glasses, but I'm old enough now, for example, to remember New England in the 1930s, in the Depression years, and to now see and feel it, felt history, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something legitimate. It may be nostalgic, but there's something legitimate about people's felt sense of history. And I think that is a legacy of the regionalists of the 1920s and 1930s. The notion that history doesn't really mean anything until it's felt somehow, whether either as a directive telling you where to go or what to do, that's mm-hmm. pretty hard, or a sense of where you've been and what's happened, a placement of oneself, and that's feeling. And I think that's the kind of history these people of mine lived, and that's the kind of history that they wrote.
John Thomas is a professor of history at Brown University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, John Thomas worked on a forthcoming study entitled The Metropolis and the Province, Perspectives on Post-Frontier America. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on the Interpretation of American Culture continues now with a conversation featuring another scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Townsend Luddington teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the author of a literary biography entitled John Dos Passos, A 20th Century Odyssey, published by Dutton Press in 1980. Here is Townsend Luddington.
Well, like a great many other American writers, poets, novelists, you name it, Dos Passos was very fond of, admired Walt Whitman, and saw what Walt Whitman as certainly one of the fathers, parents of American literature.
Mm-hmm.
But Dos Passos was very much a satirist himself. Often critics did not see him as such because he wasn't particularly humorous. And they forget that satire can be very serious.
Uh-huh.
And particularly later in his life, and I suppose later on we can get into some of this political weaving and turning and moving from one side to the other that, that Dos Passos is involved with. But anyway, later in his life, Dos Passos was very critical of the United States, as was the later Walt Whitman. And so by quoting from Democratic Vistas, I'm quoting, using the quotation from Democratic Vistas, I'm using the quotation in which Walt Whitman explains mm-hmm. his disillusionment with the great promise that America had been. But even as he is doing this, he begins moving away from the left because he becomes increasingly disenchanted with what he sees the hard line left wing doing. So that by the time, in fact, that USA, the great trilogy, you know, the nearest thing to the great American novel, as some people were trying to call it in those days, by the time that comes out in 1938 as a single volume, Dos Passos has moved way away from the left. Involved in that also is a kind of shootout with Ernest Hemingway over what the communists were trying to do in Spain in 1936-37. They disagreed, and that simply pushed Dos Passos further away from the left. But it's in the 30s that you see this swing, and a rather remarkable swing, that only a few other Americans, well, some of the neoconservatives of today, some of the older ones, are part of that same move, I think. But it's a relatively rare kind of thing to move from the far left over to the far right. I think the best way, Dos Passos tried to explain it in the days when he had moved to the right. He said he always saw himself as a liberal, but a Jeffersonian liberal. And that's very tricky, of course, because a Jeffersonian liberal can easily be defined as today's conservative. Mm-hmm.
Is he important to us today? Do you look at him today and find continuities or threads that move from his political activity in the 30s, political and artistic activities of the 30s and 40s and 50s into the 1980s? I mean, is he important only to the literary historians? Why, for example, would anybody walk into a library and pick up one of his books and read it?
There are a whole bunch of answers to that, I think. As in terms of literary history, he's important simply because at the time that he was writing, he was doing some innovative things. And so those of us who might teach literary history would say, well, here's a name to remember. Mm-hmm. Not the most important name, but somebody who, at the time that he was writing such works as Manhattan Transfer, or before that, Three Soldiers, as one of the most important works and one of the first works in response to World War I, Manhattan Transfer 1925, then the three volumes of the trilogy USA beginning in 1930. All of those are literary historically important works. Secondly, at least the latter two, Manhattan Transfer plus the three volumes of USA, are important technically. I mean, the kinds of things that Dos Passos did are now, in a sense, old hat.
This is the cinematic kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. And Dos Passos, the multiple points of view, which are not segregated in Manhattan Transfer, but by the time you get to USA, he segregates them into you've got four narrative techniques. Mm-hmm. You've got what I would call the kind of narrative line of the lives of about, I think it's 12 major figures that are segmented throughout. Mm-hmm. You've got the camera eye, which is a kind of impressionistic autobiography in somewhat stream of consciousness form. You have biographies of famous Americans like Isadora Duncan, Woodrow Wilson, Henry Ford, you name it, sports figures, movie figures, and he sees these as representative of the America of the time. Mm-hmm. And then the final sort of backdrop to all of this are segments of what he called newsreels, the old movie newsreels.
I take it that you got to know him, what, personally? He dies in what, 1970?
He died 1970, September 28th.
Exactly. Do you have, Tony Luddington, very briefly, an anecdote, a story you could tell me to illustrate the sort of person that he was, one that, you know, in your own personal experience or something that crops up in your biography of Dos Passos?
Yes. I'm not sure that it shows him too much, but I learned about him through his journals and diaries, and it was a wonderful thing to follow him along. He wrote a great deal in these, and he'd write about trips and so forth. One of the most fun times I ever had was when I was in France with my family, and we decided to take a spring trip down into Italy, and we followed Dos Passos reading, in a sense, out of his journals, describing as he moved from Positano, or let's start back a little further, as he took the train from where he was in Italy in spring of 1918 as an ambulance driver, and down to Rome, and then to Naples, and then Pompeii, mm-hmm. then walking to Castellammare and down to Sorrento, and then walking across something called the Amalfi Drive, mm-hmm. and then up the other side as far as Salerno, and then to the wonderful ruins in Pestum. And just his appreciation for them and my being able to live those through his words, in effect, was a wonderful experience, which made me like the guy a great deal. Mm-hmm. That's not exactly what you're after, perhaps, but you get a sense of it. I came to like him more and more, and I think with very few exceptions in his own life, he was an admirable person.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about some of the people that he moved amongst. They may not be household names, but...
Some of them are.
Well, friends or enemies, yeah. Supporters, detractors, that kind of thing.
That's a fascination about him, of course, is that he moved very much in the circle of the big writers of the 20s. In fact, during the 20s and 30s, certainly through the time when he wrote Adventures of a Young Man, he was thought to be the most important of them. People might argue with me about that, but there's a real case to be made. Sartre in 1930, the late 30s, I forget exactly when, after the USA had appeared, said this is the most important writer, not even American writer, this is the most important writer of our time.
Was Dos Passos then a household name? He isn't necessarily today.
No, he wasn't, because at the same time that USA was selling, say, 20,000 copies, Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath in the late 30s was selling 406,000 or something like that. Uh-huh. I'm not exaggerating. It was a tremendous number of sales, of course. Uh-huh. But he was considered an important, innovative novelist, mm-hmm. and that was his importance. But you were asking me about the people that he moved with. It was very much the crowd of Fitzgerald and Hemingway, mm-hmm. Brought together in places such as New York City. Provincetown, because Dos Passos and his first wife lived in Provincetown all through the 30s. And in fact, Dos Passos only left there after his wife Katie was killed in an auto accident. Mm-hmm. And they lived in the very house, in fact, off which the Provincetown Players did their first plays. So they moved very much in that artsy-craftsy group. Uh-huh. They were close friends, intimate friends of Gerald and Sarah Murphy. You know, the book Living Well is the Best Revenge,
right.
A wonderful, short, delightful study of Sarah and Gerald Murphy, who were a kind of catalyst for that whole group of MacLeish and uh-huh. Fitzgerald, who models the characters in Tender as the Night after the Murphys and so forth. And Hemingway moved in and out of that group. Edmund Wilson was an intimate friend till Dos Passos died, was an intimate friend, although they disagreed increasingly about politics. So that was Dos Passos' world, and it was the important literary world.
Mm-hmm. Tony Ludington, we're talking about your literary biography of John Dos Passos. What did he like most about his country? What did he like least about it? Do those things come through in some sort of crystallized fashion in the fiction, or do you have to tease them out?
That takes us right back to Walt Whitman, because he liked most about it what Walt Whitman admired about it, which was the diversity, the polyglot nature of the population, the possibilities, the opportunities. It was the same kind of theme that goes all the way back to the Puritans about mm-hmm. this land of opportunity, land of plenty. I mean, we have so many terms to express this gloriousness that the country seemed to be. That's what he admired terribly about it.
And but he didn't like what human nature would do to that.
Well, that's right. And what depressed him, it was by the time he was writing USA, which was in from roughly 1928 on, or mm-hmm. or even 29 with the depression, something had happened, and he saw that, and he was trying to chart in the three novels of the trilogy what had happened to the United States from the years 1900 to 1930.
And you mentioned what? The rise of, or the beginnings of, the consumer culture?
Yeah, I mean, this had happened before, of course, but mm-hmm. these are the kinds of things he could see, particularly in the face of all that the 20s appeared to be in the face of the Depression, which hit in 1929. Uh-huh. And so, you know, what he's saying, in fact, hey, we have to do a reassessment. But he felt that he was trying to, somebody uses a term that Dos Passos tried to swallow America whole, and I think that's probably pretty true, that over the course of his career, with all of his work, and he wrote an awful lot of history in his later days, as well as the fiction, and threw in a few plays and so on and so forth. But in all of this, he's trying to get hold of America, what it is, and try to say, look here, people, this is what's going on, this is what should be going on.
Why do you think he deserved a literary biography? Is it just the work? Is it the life? We're back to that that question. And what one thought would you leave with a general audience about Dos Passos, his importance, the importance of his life, the importance of his writing?
He deserves a literary biography because I chose to write about him.
Yeah.
He's an interesting personality.
Uh-huh.
Not flamboyant, as I've said, but a man with a great many interests whose career weaves in and out of all kinds of different areas, political, social, fascination with the United States itself. I mean, the part of the thing of when you take on a biography is that a person may be totally unknown, but it's an interesting story, mm-hmm. and you want to tell that story.
It's a narrative about a bunch of narratives.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. I keep coming back to the relative importance of his literary output. Because the stuff holds up well. The mm-hmm. best of his stuff holds up very well.
And does it sell well today?
No, not terribly well, but it remains in print, and mm-hmm. that in itself is a sign. I'll tell you where it does sell well is abroad.
Hmm.
Even during his life, this was the case, and books that didn't do particularly well in this country did very well in translation, for example, in Latin America. He also, at least until his shift from left to right, was popular in Eastern European countries, which is quite true of, for instance, people that aren't read much anymore in this country, like, say, Jack London or Sinclair Lewis. They are very popular abroad because they are social commentators, and that's what he was doing, and that's why people would liked him then, and I would say why people might still get a great kick out of it. But you get a wonderful story, a fast-paced narrative about sort of a panoramic view of the United States in USA. And that in itself has a good deal of merit.
Townsend Ludington teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the author of a literary biography entitled John Dos Passos, A 20th Century Odyssey, published by Dutton Press in 1980. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Townsend Ludington worked on a forthcoming biography of the American artist Marston Hartley. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on the Interpretation of American Culture is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a retrospective on the life and work of the English novelist Charles Dickens, who was born 176 years ago in February of 1812. My guest will be Robert Patton of Rice University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Partial support for Soundings comes from The Leader, News of the Research Triangle. Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Interpreting American Culture, this week on Soundings. John Thomas of Brown University discusses his forthcoming study of American regionalism, and Townsend Ludington of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill talks about his literary biography of the novelist John Dos Passos. Interpreting American Culture, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.